Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When I was young and my parents had divorced, my mom and I moved to a trailer on the outskirts of town. The trailer was situated in front with a country road and across the fence in a field in the back near an interstate. Even though there was access to a major road, the home still felt safe. Safe enough that I would often ride my bike alone along the country road in front of my house. There were only a couple of times I recall my mom feeling scared because of the location of our home. Once was returning home from church on a Sunday night to find that our trailer door was wide open. I remember sitting in the car terrified while my mom went inside to check every room and closet. In that instance, she ended up deciding that she must have left the door cracked when we rushed out for church and the wind had blown it open further. Another time I recall is late one night, there being a knock and crying at the front door. Someone had a car that had broken down on the interstate behind our house, and the woman had come to the closest home with a light on, hours, to make a phone call. Even though my mom helped the woman, I could see that there was some fear in my mom's eyes, not knowing if this woman were truly alone, as she said. In both of those cases, my mother and I were still safe, despite the potential of the opposite circumstance. Armed with that sense of safety, I would ride my bike down those roads in front of my house, even going further than I knew I was supposed to. It never crossed my mind that going too far away from the watchful eyes of neighbors could lead to disastrous consequences. And for me, it didn't. But I'm one of the lucky ones. Our case today will prove that danger can lurk anywhere, even in very public places, even in broad daylight. This is the case of Anne Gottlieb.
Welcome to Coffee and Cases, where we like our coffee hot and our cases cold. My name is Allison Williams.
And my name is Maggie Dameron. We will be telling stories each week in the hopes that someone out there with any information concerning the cases will take those tips to law enforcement so justice and closure can be brought to these families. With each case, we encourage you to continue in the conversation on our Facebook page, Coffee and Cases Podcast, because, as we all know, conversation helps to keep the missing person in the public consciousness, helping to keep their memories alive. So sit back, sip your coffee, and listen to what's brewing this week.
I'm assuming from your introduction that Anne is a child, so we're doing a child case today?
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
So prepare yourself.
Yeah,
I know these are
mentally prepare.
Yeah, a lot harder. And Maggie, I am bringing you this week another case that was a suggestion from one of our listeners.
Oh.
I actually have about, I think, 7 case suggestions
Wow.
that I'm currently working on at the moment. So some are in the stages of research, some in the stages of interviews, but this was one of them that I was working on.
Okay.
And it is another case, actually, that is local to us since it happened in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay. And makes it a little more scary and a little more
real.
Yeah, real.
Yeah. Yeah. Our case today does include some graphic and disturbing details, so listener discretion is advised. Now, normally at this point, I start with some background information on the individual at the center of our case this week. But this time, because of what you mentioned, her being a child, I'm going to take it a step back and tell you about her parents since Anne was only 12 years old at the time our case took place in 1983.
Okay.
Reporter Andrew Wolfson gave this background information in his article for the Louisville Courier-Journal on Anne's case. And in that article, he tells us that Anatoly Gottlieb, Anne's father, was born in 1938 in Kiev, Ukraine, though his family actually fled to Siberia only a few years later in 1941 when the Nazis invaded.
Oh, wow. Were they Jewish?
They were. Yes. So there, once they returned to Ukraine, Anatoly studied engineering at Kiev Polytechnic, which is not the same polytechnic that we talked about with Dyatlov Pass.
Okay.
Because I couldn't remember what, I remembered Polytechnic, and I was like, wait, is this, and it wasn't the same one. They were quite like 35 hours apart, so not even close. But Anatoly did return to Ukraine, and he also married Ludmilla, his wife, in 1970, and their daughter Anne was born a year later in 1971.
Do you know, I wonder sometimes if, which I'm sure they do, but like people in other countries, if they're like, Allison, that's a really strange name.
Right.
That's difficult
Maggie.
To say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is this? Yeah. Well, much like the decision that Anatoly's family faced when he was younger, Anatoly, Ludmilla, and daughter Anne were facing oppression in the Soviet Union. So, like his parents, the family immigrated to safety. Anatoly moved his family in 1980 to the United States.
And Anne was pretty old. I mean, not old, but
nine-ish.
Old enough to remember all of that by then.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here in the U.S., Anatoly got a job working for the construction and engineering company, the Bechtel Group. Specifically, he worked for Bechtel Petroleum.
Okay.
So, smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
Young Ann Gottlieb, only around 10, like I said, 9 or 10 at the time of the move, she adapted quickly, and she was actually able to speak fluent Russian and English. And from what I read, pretty well without an accent.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. She made some close friends. She loved to ride her bike. She did well in school. She spent quite a bit of time, actually, in the Jewish Community Center in Louisville, which wasn't very far from the family's home on Gerald Court.
What is a Jewish Community Center? Is it just like a church or like a synagogue, rather?
I think it's more like a YMCA type of place. So for the Jewish community in Louisville, a place where they could socialize, exercise, different things like that.
Gotcha.
So luckily, I mean, moving here, she had things like that where she could, it could help her with adapting and the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to June 1st, 1983. The then 5'1", 85-pound, red-haired, gray-eyed, 12-year-old Anne Gottlieb was so excited because it was the first day of summer vacation.
Oh, yeah. That's a very exciting day. So random, but today we're state testing in Kentucky right now, which is exhausting. And at the end of the day, after we were done testing, I put on, and the other teacher that was in the room with me, like a 10-minute meditation video. And it was like, think of the happiest moment and visualize this moment. Soak it in. Feel the happiness. And at first I was like, oh, the day my baby was born. And then I was like, no, that's going to make me sad. So then I was like, the first day of summer break when the bell rings on the last day of school.
Yes. Yeah. For those of you out there listening, the first day of summer vacation, this is an excitement that we feel every year as an educator.
Yeah.
It's this feeling of freedom, and endless possibilities.
Endless naps.
That's right. So on Anne's first day of summer vacation, she had spent the day at the Jewish Community Center on Dutchman's Lane. She had taken a bus there, and she had this great day of fun playing tennis with her friend Rachel Podgorski until Rachel's mom actually had picked the girls up, and she had dropped Anne off at home. And from there, Anne had gotten on her bike to ride to another friend's house, Tanya Okmiansky. And there she wanted to watch television with her friend. So this is like perfect day for a 12-year-old, right? Yeah. Up to this point. According to an article by Jennifer Bailey for WLKY, missing persons detective Mike Perry told her the following, quote, "They stayed there for about an hour or so. Anne's mother called and told Anne to come home. Both girls left the apartment and rode down Bashford Manor Lane, where they got to the parking lot of the Bashford Manor Mall at 3600 Bardstown Road. At that time, to my understanding, Anne's friend said, 'I'll see you,' waved goodbye to Anne," end quote. So they're watching television. Anne's mom calls and says, "Hey, go ahead and head this way, head home." And so the two girls kind of ride in the same direction toward Anne's home. And by the way, this mall, it's like a block or so away from Anne's house. I mean, very close. There were some initial reports that Anne may have gone inside the mall, Maggie, you'll understand this, to a pet store to pet a kitten.
Yes, I would also stop by to pet a kitten or a dog.
You would always. But, we don't know for sure if she did, but there were reports that she did. Mm-hmm. We only know that Anne was last seen between 5:30 and 6 p.m. on June 1st, and that Anne's friend made it home while Anne Gottlieb did not. Sensing something was wrong when Anne didn't return, the family actually went out looking for her, and eventually they found Anne's bike propped against a brick wall at the Bashford Manor Mall outside of Bacon's department store.
Oh, so like she did just like run in for a second.
And that's what it looked like. Yeah, like she had just left the bike there to run in the mall. But, Mag, there was a singular detail about the way the bike was left that told her family they needed to immediately call law enforcement, that someone had taken Anne.
Interesting. I'm intrigued.
In an article for WLKY published on May 7th, 2015, reporter Jennifer Bailey's interviewed FBI agent Ed Armento, who told her how the bike itself told them that this was a case of a likely abduction. Quote, "All of her friends and family told us that she never used the kickstand. Whenever she went anywhere with a bike, she laid the bike down on its side, never employed the kickstand. When we found the bike, it was leaning against the wall of Bacon's department store at the Bashford Manor Mall. The kickstand was down, which gave us reason to believe that whoever put the bike against the wall was not Anne Gottlieb," end quote.
And, you know, I think that's something that would be very memorable for a kid to do. Like, oh, I'm stepping over Anne's bike again in the yard because she's just, you know,
right, exactly,
down or whatever.
And one, I did not read this in multiple sources, but one source did say that the kickstand was broken and that that's why she didn't normally use it. So it's almost as though when they see that, they're thinking somebody took Anne and then posed her bike here.
Yeah.
Somebody else has placed it here. Within days, Anne's parents, Anatoly and Ludmilla Gottlieb, made public pleas through the media for the return of their sweet Anne. Tips and theories, Maggie, came flooding in. Of course, as with most of the cases that we cover, not all of those theories were legitimate nor well-founded.
Yeah.
For example, there was a theory that Anne had been kidnapped by people working for the Russian government because they were trying to either punish her father Anatoly or force him back to Russia.
Why?
I have no idea why this rumor started, but the rumor that perpetuated that theory was that the company that Anatoly worked for here in the U.S., it was rumored to have ties with the CIA. Mm. And so with Anatoly's original Russian roots,
gotcha,
this theory was born. But Anne's parents and others have dismissed this theory completely, basically arguing that had he had some sort of knowledge that the Russian government wanted, then he wouldn't have been allowed to immigrate here in the first place.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Yes. Another theory was that Anne had decided to run away of her own free will. I know. And the quote-unquote support for this theory was that at the time she went missing, she was reading a book called Still Missing. And in the book, a mother is very upset after it appears that her son was abducted and his bike was left behind, leaned against a brick wall.
Okay, so similar.
It is eerily similar. I will give it that. But I feel like you can't discount coincidence in this case because most people in the early 80s, most kids in the early 80s had a bike as their transportation. So it's not that uncommon mm-hmm. to say the bike was left leaning yeah. against a brick
Especially
wall.
If like your neighborhood is as Anne sounds that it was and you could quickly bike from your house to the mall right. to your friend's house, you know, not so yeah. country like where we grew up.
Right. And those close to Anne said that she wasn't experiencing any anxiety at the time. But I will say, according to an entry on Anne's disappearance that was published on the website, the Resource Center for Cold Case Missing Children's Cases, it did say that Anne was upset after her most recent birthday when very few of her classmates had shown up.
But like upset enough to run away?
That's what I'm saying. I know. That doesn't make sense to me. And then I did read, this was according to the Charlie Project, there were several reported sightings of Anne after her disappearance near the Brighton Beach neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, which is quite a distance away.
Yeah.
But it is a neighborhood which, according to that article, had a high concentration of Russian immigrants. But none of those sightings were ever substantiated. And all of this leads us to the big question. What is the likelihood that a 12-year-old could have run away of her own free will and have covered her tracks so well that in all of the years since and without a dime of money on her could have remained undetected?
So I'm assuming because we have the theories about her potentially running away and the sightings in maybe New York that we've never found a body.
We have not.
Hmm. I just think, like, the running away theory and she's living in Brooklyn, I think that would just be so hard to do. I feel like I would end up slipping up. Like, even if I changed my name, I would end up making a mistake. Or people are going to connect that, you know, and be like, oh, this is probably this Anne girl that's missing. And they would tell somebody something. I just think that would be hard to live that out your whole life.
Yeah. And if you have no money and you're 12 years old, how are you getting there?
Right.
And that means even more people would know. And that's even more people who would have to keep a secret.
Because you would have had to hitchhike, I'm assuming. So they would say, oh yeah, I saw that girl. I gave her a ride.
Yeah. I don't get it. And had she hitched a ride with somebody, she wouldn't have left her bike with the kickstand down.
That's true.
Another theory arose about 3 days after Anne's disappearance when, according to the Charlie Project, a police bloodhound picked up Anne's scent near a ditch by the mall.
Hmm.
Trailing that scent, the bloodhound, not once, but twice, led law enforcement to the window of an apartment across the street from the mall. The person who rented that apartment was Esther Okmiansky, the grandmother of Tanya Okmiansky, Anne's best friend. yeah, and the last person to see Anne alive. However, Esther maintained that not only had she not seen Anne that day, but that Anne had never even ever visited her apartment.
I wonder if maybe the friend had like clothing of hers, you know, borrowed a sweatshirt or something like that, and that's what the dog picked up.
See, I thought that too. But when, so law enforcement, they did look into this lead, and it ended up that all of the family had solid alibis. They were all cleared of involvement, but their explanation for trailing the scent there twice was that they believed the bloodhound had been distracted by the smell of food cooking, which, number one, okay, of course, I've been there. I've been distracted by the scent of food cooking. Yeah. But how often have we seen that kind of mistake happen with bloodhounds?
And
never.
I think that these particular bloodhounds, right, you know, police bloodhounds, would be specifically trained not to be distracted. That'd be like if you said it. Drug dog was distracted by Chick-fil-A at the airport.
Right. Yeah. Oh, just kidding. Yeah. We hit on a scent.
Unless it was maybe, you know, like still kind of in training, because Anthony and I did have that happen to us the last time that we went to Mexico. They had a drug dog that was in training and it smelled of Anthony as he went by. So we had to empty all of our bags and be checked by TSA.
Oh.
And they were like, we're sorry, he's still in training. He's done that about 4 times today.
Oh.
So maybe it was that.
Maybe. I don't know. I didn't read that it was in training, but we'll give it the benefit of the doubt. There were calls also that came in about 2 Russian women who were seen accompanying a young redheaded Russian girl going to get some passport photos, and that they seemed in a rush. This was actually shortly after Anne's disappearance, several weeks, but shortly after. That was reported by multiple people because the first photography center that this trio stopped in was unable to help them get the passport photos and had suggested a different photographer. And that photographer told this to police as well. But we don't know whether or not or how that lead may have been discounted other than reading that it was. Some theories focused on the potential of child predators. According to reporter Shay McAllister for WHAS 11, more theories explored were a 26-year-old man from Somerset who had previously kidnapped a child and tied them up with shoestrings.
Oh.
Another lead that was explored was a man from Louisville who was under investigation for raping a child. So they're really looking at all the potential avenues. Then, Maggie, a much more concretely fleshed out theory arose.
Okay.
Around 2 p.m. on the day Anne went missing, there had been a man at the Jewish Community Center who had gone on a rampage. That's the best word I can think of. To terrorize young girls.
Oh.
On June 1st, 1983. He had molested a 10-year-old girl on the jogging track at the center.
Okay, this wasn't the rampage I was picturing. I was thinking like he got mad and was throwing chairs and things. Okay.
Yeah, it's worse than that.
Okay.
Yes, that happened on the jogging track at the center. From there, he went on to expose himself to 2 6-year-old girls. This was on a residential street just a couple of miles from the mall. And the way it connects with Anne was that she had been playing tennis at the Jewish Community Center around the same time that this man had been there. So it led law enforcement to question, had he seen Anne at the center and chosen to victimize her? Had he followed her? I mean, you can see why he became a suspect.
Do we know who this man is? Did we find him?
We do find him.
Okay.
Let me tell you a little bit more about him first.
Okay.
So police initially, they were just armed with a description of the man that they had from the 3 victims, the 10-year-old girl and
so
the 2
traumatizing.
Six-year-olds.
Can you imagine that?
Oh, my, I don't know if it's okay to admit to this. I would strangle somebody who did that to my child. They had at least a description. And according to an article on Anne's case on that website, the Resource Center for Cold Case Missing Children's Cases, they described a man in his 40s wearing athletic shoes and a, quote, floppy white golf hat, end quote. Sketches of this man were posted, prompting on June 3rd, so only 2 days later, two teenaged girls who had witnessed something, they said, on June 1st. They said that they had been crossing a field walking toward the mall when they saw a man force a small girl into the wooded area near the Royal Arms Apartments on Bashford Manor Lane. And they had initially said that they believed that this was like a parent child. But then seeing the sketch and hearing about Anne's disappearance, now they wondered if what they had witnessed was actually Anne's abduction.
Oh, good Lord. And also traumatizing.
Yes. They, too, said that the man was wearing a light-colored, they called it a fishing hat instead of a golf hat. However, the search of the woodlands where they said that they saw this man and a young girl going into the woods, they searched it for a period of multiple days in multiple locations, and it produced no sign of Anne. Luckily, though, their search didn't end there. They also, after they sent the sketch out, had several people call in with the license plate of a man that they had seen committing these crimes a few days before. So people saw him do things and then had jotted down his license plate as he was driving away. This man's name was Ralph Barry Barber, a 42-year-old from Nicholasville, Kentucky. No surprise, Maggie, he had a history of arrests for sexual offenses. According to the Resource Center for Cold Case Missing Children's Cases, quote, he was actually arrested on a charge of indecent exposure in 1965.
Oh,
we're going way back.
Yeah.
And even had to be treated for sexual impulse disorder in 1978. According to reports, he admitted to molesting the child at the Jewish Community Center and also for exposing himself to the two young six-year-old children.
He should have been in an institution after the first incident.
He even admitted to abusing a half dozen other children in Kentucky and Indiana. However, Barber denied involvement in the Gottlieb case and claimed he never touched or harmed her when she disappeared. He also had an airtight alibi for the time that she was reportedly abducted, end quote. And those two teenage girls who had said that they saw this same man with a girl going into the woods actually recanted their statements. And that alibi that he had, that solid alibi, was that he had driven from Louisville to Lexington, Kentucky, and had visited a trophy shop.
It's just so scary saying names of cities
that we
in
know
your state that we know to. Yeah,
especially when you get to the smaller towns that we know. So the reason why his alibi is airtight is because this trophy shop, multiple employees at that trophy shop place him there between 5:30 and 6, which is the time that Anne had disappeared. And they actually remember because it was right at closing time. And so, you know, if you've ever worked in retail and somebody walks in right before closing time, that's when he had walked in and he had a plaque that he wanted engraved. And so he had given them his name. And so that's why his alibi seemed legitimate. The Resource Center for Cold Case Missing Children's Cases website, they also said that the police, they didn't, even while they were kind of following that lead, they were also searching empty apartments and homes in the area. They were even checking their closets and refrigerators in those homes. They checked fields, they checked creeks, and they found no clues.
Wow. So it's almost like she did just disappear.
Police even wondered if Anne's disappearance had been connected to an abduction and sexual assault of a 15-year-old from Gardner Lane Shopping Center that had occurred just one day after Anne's disappearance. So here's another shopping center. Here's another young child who was abducted and sexually assaulted. But police were never able to catch the perpetrator in that crime.
Oh.
Then, a few months later, in January 1984, another name first came across the desks of law enforcement. Gregory Lewis Oakley Jr.
Oh, so many names.
And well, you know what we say about people with names. But Oakley became a focus because in September 1983, and remember, Anne disappears June 1st, 1983.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking just a couple months after. In September 1983, Oakley had broken into a home about a mile and a half from where Anne disappeared. In the home, he had threatened a young 13-year-old girl with a knife and demanded that she undress. She resisted.
What's wrong with people?
I know. You know, at times I find myself thinking how much worse the world is today.
Yeah, but then when
and
we
then
do
I'm reminded
like
that
this,
it's always been bad.
Nope, it's always been. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Always has been. So he threatened her with a knife and demanded that she undress. She resisted. And as a result, he stabbed her in the back before fleeing. Luckily, she survived. And not only was she able to describe the man in detail, but also describe the vehicle that he drove away
in,
which allowed police to track him down. And it was Oakley. Law enforcement, though, Maggie, I don't know if you're ready for this. If you thought that last one was bad, wait till I tell you about this
Lord.
One. Lord. Law enforcement found a sordid background from Oakley that was quite shocking at his actions, at how long it had been going on, and at how he had barely gotten any punishment for his actions. An article about Anne's case by the Associated Press notes that Oakley had grown up in Pine Apple, Alabama, and that he had a doctorate in veterinary medicine from Auburn University.
So very smart.
Very. And while I don't know if there were any crimes previous to July 1979, from that point on, there are many. According to a Wave 3 story published December 4th, 2008, in Alabama in July 1979, Oakley was identified as a suspect in the attempted abduction of a 13-year-old girl, and he had used a hypodermic needle to try to sedate her. Before she, as he's trying to use it, she was able to fight back and then was able to flee.
Oh, my.
Then also in July 1979 in Alabama, Oakley assaulted another 13-year-old female, injecting her with catamine as a sedative. Again, sexual assault, and then fleeing the scene. So he's, I get the sense that he's using the drugs that he would have access to as a vet.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I feel like he's using his veterinarian knowledge.
Two years later, in November 1981, still in Alabama, Oakley assaulted another 13-year-old, his own stepdaughter. Yes. Before the sexual assault, he injected her with Demerol.
Oh, ma.
Yes. For this plea, because he pled guilty to assault, he only ended up getting 2 years probation. But
what is wrong with the justice system?
Yeah. And that was because his charges were reduced to second-degree assault because he agreed to plead guilty. With his charges, though, Oakley lost his veterinary license and had moved to Louisville in 1982, where he took a job as a USDA meat inspector. So he would travel around to inspect various slaughterhouses.
So I know that he's in Louisville then, but Louisville's a pretty big city. So I wonder, were we able to put him near where Anne was last seen?
I'll get to that. In September 1983, so I'm jumping back after Anne's disappearance, and then I'll come back to your question. In September 1983, his crime spree began again when he attempted to abduct two young females who were walking to school along Goldsmith Lane, only a few blocks from Bashford Manor Mall, where Anne Gottlieb had disappeared 3 months earlier. It was also in September 1983 when Oakley had assaulted that young girl that he stabbed, whom I just told you about. Mm-hmm. Side note, after he was charged for that crime with the stabbing in 1984, when he was already in jail, because he's awaiting trial for that crime in Jefferson County, he was also charged with the assault and attempted rape of a young girl in Hikes Point.
Golly.
Yeah, repeat offender.
Yeah.
And in addition to all of that, Maggie, Shay McAllister from WHAS 11 noted that Oakley lived a block and a half from Anne Gottlieb and only two blocks from the mall at the time of Anne's disappearance. Okay. So yes, we can place him in that area. While in custody in 1984 for that attack on the young girl in late 1983, police actually questioned him about his potential involvement in the disappearance of Anne Gottlieb. He denied having anything to do with Anne.
Well, obviously, people, I don't think he'd be like, yeah, I kidnapped her. I took her here.
Right. And he did fail his polygraph test. Again, I know. Polygraph. I get it. A piece of evidence that was quite damning to Oakley, though, was that law enforcement discovered an ATM receipt from Liberty National Bank, which was right there at the mall, at 3:50 p.m. on June 1st. So less than 2 hours before Anne Gottlieb disappeared from that location. However, Oakley explained that by saying, well, I had withdrawn the money, and then I had immediately gone out of town on a business trip.
Can we verify that he was out of town on a business trip?
His girlfriend at the time said that he was out of town on a business trip.
I don't know how, this is probably really mean to me of me to say, but I'm going to say it. I don't know how anyone could date someone like him.
I don't think she knew at the time.
Okay.
About his past.
Okay.
Because, you know, when he made that move to Kentucky.
Yeah, he probably just kind of wanted to get away from all that.
Changed his job, changed all of that. And then everything else that I told you about that happened really happened after Anne's disappearance.
Okay.
Right, those other crimes. So at the time when Anne's disappearance was being investigated, the girlfriend said, yep, he was away on a business trip. And I mean, it was true that he often traveled for his work with the USDA. I mean, he traveled all over Kentucky to West Virginia and to Texas. So it wasn't out of the question.
Okay.
But what made police skeptical of his alibi was that Oakley's cellmate, because remember he was in jail after those crimes from September 1983, his cellmate told police that Oakley had actually confessed to him that he had abducted and murdered Anne Gottlieb.
You know, and I know a lot of the times inmates will say things that aren't true.
Yes.
But some of the times, you know, they do tell the truth. But why would you tell a person you met in jail and a person you've probably only known for a short amount of time if you did commit a crime like that? Like, I just don't understand people.
I know. Unless they just feel like they need to
get it off their chest, maybe.
Well, here is what he said Oakley told him. This cellmate said that at some point in 1989, according to him, Oakley confessed to abducting Anne and sedating her using a drug called Talwin. According to one source I read, the cellmate said that Oakley told him that she had overdosed or he had given her too much. Another source said that she had had some sort of adverse reaction to the Talwin. Hmm. And that because of that, Oakley admitted to strangling Anne. But
I Googled Talwin because I'd never heard of it. Mm-hmm. And it says that it can cause respiratory distress or even death when taken in high doses. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know which theory or story is the one that he heard. I read it in different sources. Both of them said Talwin. Both of them said that he admitted to the cellmate that he had killed Anne, but how that death happened differed. But Maggie, the cellmate, was given a polygraph test concerning what he said of Oakley's confession, and deception was indicated.
Okay, so the polygraph says he's lying about it.
Right. And I mean, you said it. We've seen this kind of deception many times before because they'll do it for a lighter sentence. Maybe it's to get transferred to a different location for whatever reason. And when the lead detective from the Louisville Metro Police Department was asked to hand over all of his documentation on Anne's case to the FBI, so we're getting like the big guns coming in, it seemed like that was the end of the focus on the Oakley theory. I mean, ultimately, it appeared as though there just wasn't enough evidence to link him to Anne's case.
Well, I do think that a lot of it is, if we're playing like a devil's advocate, kind of circumstantial, you know, with the bank withdrawal. Right. And, I mean, he lived close by, so.
Right. And he's a horrible human being.
Yeah.
So, though there was enough to sentence him to a 30-year prison sentence for the attack in September 1983 of the other young girl. But he did not serve his full sentence. So he did serve until June of 2002. And that was when Oakley received a medical release from prison, which I didn't even know,
I didn't know was a thing.
And he moved back to Alabama. He had been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. And he actually did pass away just a few months after his medical release in October of 2002. Up until his death, Oakley maintained that he had no ties to Anne Gottlieb. According to an article in the Louisville Courier-Journal by Andrew Wolfson, Oakley wrote a letter to them stating, quote, "I have never seen Anne Gottlieb in my life," end quote, and said he had, quote, "no reason to lie about this matter because I'm dealing with terminal lung cancer, which has already metastasized," end quote. So basically insinuating that if he had something to share about his involvement, death is imminent and he has nothing to lose now and would admit to it.
I mean, again, I can see why we would look into him, but I kind of see his point too. You know, if death is on the doorstep, why try to hide it?
I mean, it's not like he's going to get a worse sentence.
Right.
Or something like that. Another lead surfaced in 1990 when a serial killer on death row named Michael Lee Lockhart confessed to Anne's abduction and murder. He told authorities that he was stationed in Fort Knox at the time and that after killing Anne, he had buried her body on some land near Fort Knox. When authorities looked into his claim, he was stationed at Fort Knox in 1983, and Fort Knox is less than an hour's drive from Louisville.
So this man, this serial killer, says when he was in the army at Fort Knox that he killed Anne and then buried her somewhere near Fort Knox.
Yes, this is the story that he said.
Yeah, it is close to there.
It is.
Okay, I'm going to let you continue with this one before I say anything else.
Well, I will say that like Oakley's cellmate, Lockhart also failed a polygraph.
Why would you lie?
Don't know. Subsequent searches of the areas that he had indicated around Fort Knox where the burial had happened didn't lead to any developments. And Lockhart was executed in December 1997. So without more details, there are some who still believe his confession. In all, law enforcement actually questioned between 30 and 40 different suspects over the years.
Wow.
And for years, there seemed to be lots of possibilities, but no clear leads pointing to one over another. They were all just theories. Then 6 more years passed, and it was now June 2008, the 25th anniversary of Anne's disappearance, and the police received a phone call from a woman who had been Oakley's girlfriend at the time of Anne's disappearance, and she had something to tell police. According to her, Oakley had left town for a work trip. So that was true. He had left town for a work trip. He made it sound like he left at a different time. He had actually left for the work trip on May 31st, 1983, but had returned home the following night on June 1st around 11 p.m., which was only 5 hours after Anne was last seen. Plus, this now threw his alibi of leaving town after that ATM withdrawal on June 1st into question.
Yeah.
So he said, no, I withdrew that money from the ATM at 3:50 and then I left town for the work trip. Now his girlfriend is saying, no, that's not true at all. He left town on the 31st. He came home on June 1st at 11 p.m. What's more, when he returned home, Maggie, she said that he had asked that she wash his clothes because they had traces of blood on them.
Which, didn't he work in like meats or whatever?
He did. Yeah, that was not uncommon for him to get blood spatter on him. But she said that he usually wasn't concerned about immediately washing the clothes to get the blood stains out. So given the time that she said he returned, was this blood an indication of something similar? His ex-girlfriend also said that Oakley would often talk about Anne's disappearance.
That's a definite sign of guilt.
Especially whenever it would be in the media for an anniversary or something like that. And according to the Doe Network, quote, he said that if they didn't find her shortly, that she's gone, they would never find her, end quote. So was he just speculating or was he stating facts? Yeah. In September 2008, law enforcement actually decided to follow back up with Oakley's former cellmate, the one who had previously said that Oakley confessed to him. 25 years later, that cellmate told them essentially the same story.
Which is crazy, because that's a good amount of time.
Yes, of the overdose from the Talwin injection. And that led police to kind of go back to that old adage in their mind of, you don't have to have a good memory if you're telling the truth.
Right.
Because like you said, that's a long 25 years.
Yeah, a long time to remember a lie you've told.
Exactly. You wouldn't remember a lie. But if it's the truth, you'd likely remember it. And this time, the cellmate passed the polygraph. And, you know, after all, you have to admit, the drugs that Oakley used I would imagine are not so commonplace that the average person would be able to fabricate a story with the technical name for a drug.
Yeah, I had never heard of it.
Yeah. I'd never heard of Talwin. Mm-mm. So to fabricate the name of a drug, I mean, that doesn't make much sense. As a result, in December 2008, the Louisville Metro Police Department held a press conference where they officially named Oakley as the prime suspect in Ann's disappearance. According to an article from WLKY by Jennifer Bailey's on May 7th, 2015, quote, "He was a suspect early on in the case, but the problem was he had an alibi from his girlfriend. When he passed away, the girlfriend provided significant information to the police department, which implicated him in the case," end quote. And that was from FBI agent Ed Armento.
Mm.
Missing person detective Mike Perry said in that same article from 2015 that he planned to retest the evidence because he said, quote, "There was a fingerprint taken off the bicycle that was reviewed through the records at the time with no match."
But if he hadn't been arrested, then his fingerprint wouldn't have been in there.
I know. So that is true. But he had, and I don't know how much interstate communication there was then, because Oakley had been arrested.
Oh, yeah, in Alabama.
Yeah. So, and I'll tell you, he said that in 2015 that he was going to retest the fingerprints. And especially if they've named Oakley as the prime suspect and we know his history, I actually didn't read any update on whether that fingerprint matched Oakley nor any of the other leads that police followed.
And I don't think, I mean, I have no idea, obviously, but I feel like that wouldn't take a lot of effort.
Right. And if we have it, why not say that
Why not do it? Yeah.
Despite work still needing to be done to establish conclusive evidence, LMPD Major Barry Wilkerson told WHAS 11 Shay McAllister, quote, "I think I have every bit of probable cause to make the arrest if he were alive," end quote.
Mm.
So basically saying, if Oakley were still alive,
he'd be arrested.
He has probable cause. But if that were true, Ann's parents, they actually wanted a posthumous conviction against Oakley. However, her parents were denied their request by the Commonwealth attorney. In fact, it's my understanding that, unless this has changed in the last couple of years, that her family has actually never seen the evidence that police have against Oakley. And I know that the police, I don't know if they released all of it. They did actually release some of it just a couple of years ago. But again, I've never read whether the fingerprints were tied to Oakley or what it is that make them so convinced that he was the perpetrator. And as a result from the research I've done, her family, they're not fully convinced of this deduction that was made by police, especially because the case remains an open one. So Maggie, what are your thoughts?
I honestly am leaning towards Oakley. I just feel like there was so much evidence that pointed in his direction. But I'm curious, if we're saying he is a suspect, why we haven't ran the fingerprint. That's my one kind of holdup.
Right. Like, why not at least say this case is closed? Why would you deny the family the posthumous conviction?
Yeah, and because I feel as an investigator, you would want as many closed cases as possible. So
exactly.
Why not wrap it up?
Give them some closure.
Mm-hmm.
Finally put this case to rest. Why keep it open?
Exactly.
For quite some time after Ann's disappearance, her parents kept the same phone number, just in case, because they held on to some small hope that she could be alive and one day reach out. But in the aftermath, her parents didn't speak much about her case. The reason why they were private about it is likely addressed in one of the few interviews they did about the case. It's in a WHAS article by Kayla Moody that was updated on January 1st, 2018. Here's what Moody wrote, quote, We went through these cases just to see if there was something we missed, some piece of the puzzle that we really needed to put in place. And that's kind of what happened with the Ann Gottlieb case, end quote, LMPD Major Barry Wilkerson said. 34 years since Ann Gottlieb's disappearance, one piece of that puzzle is still missing. The same piece missing from her mother's heart. Ann's body has never been found. It weighs heavily in our hearts, and I don't think time ever heals anything, she said. It's like living with disease or constant pain. You just learn to live with it and keep it to yourself and not to impose it on other people. I'm always thankful for the community support that we had during this time, especially when it happened. I was flooded by letters, by prayers and donations. I'll never forget that. I remember telling myself, if she's found, I'm going to sit down and answer every letter. But unfortunately, that never happened, end quote. While the Gottlieb family didn't get answers, Ann's disappearance, among other public missing children's cases at the time, actually led to the creation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, in an attempt to not only raise awareness, but to strengthen communication among departments in such cases. Ann's case was one of the first missing child posters that the NCMEC produced, and her case was one of the first to use a billboard to raise awareness. Sadly for Ann's parents, the tips that resulted were not enough to bring closure. That is something her family still desperately needs. Anyone with information is asked to call the Louisville Metropolitan Police Department at 502-574-7111 or the Federal Bureau of Investigation Louisville, Kentucky office at 502-263-6000.
Again, please like and join our Facebook page, Coffee and Cases Podcast, to continue the conversation and see images related to this episode. As always, follow us on Twitter at Cases Coffee, on Instagram at Coffee Cases Podcast, or you can always email us suggestions to coffeeandcasespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about our podcast so more people can be reached to possibly help bring some closure to these families. Don't forget to rate our show and leave us a comment as well. We hope to hear from you soon.
Stay together.
Stay safe.
We'll see you next week.